So good afternoon, everyone. My name is Eliezer Diamond. I'm an associate professor of Talmud and Rabbinics at the Jewish Theological Seminary of America in Manhattan, which, among other things, has a rabbinical school for the conservative movement. I grew up Orthodox, and at a certain point that was not working for me, and I moved to the conservative movement. My ordination actually is Orthodox. I got my PhD at the Jewish Theological Seminary. And it occurred to me, and I'll share this for what it's worth, I was struck by how many people here have moved from one faith community to another. And a word that we could use for that is seekers. And I don't know if people here have read Robert Wuthnow's book, After Heaven, Spirituality in America Since the 1950s. It's a wonderful book, and one of the things that he talks about there is how, since the 60s, the model for religious life has been that of seeking, the assumption that you can't necessarily stay in one place and assume that you're going to find everything that you need. And I would like to suggest to myself and anyone else who wants to take this advice that maybe what we can learn from that is that we can seek wisdom from all traditions and hopefully get some. So until now, we've been starting with the rabbi. So I'm going to mix it up, especially because when I was growing up, there were plenty of jokes that there wasn't imams in those days, but the joke began, there was a priest, a minister, and a rabbi. And the joke went on from there. So we'll start at my extreme left with Dr. Umar Farouk Abdallah. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Dr. Abdallah received his doctorate at the University of Chicago in 1978. He has taught in quite a number of institutions. University of Windsor, Windsor, Ontario, Temple University, University of Michigan, in Spain, at the Albayacin, if that's the correct pronunciation, Arabic Institute, and at King Abdulaziz University in Saudi Arabia. And he now is chairman of the board and scholar in residence at the Nawawi Foundation. And as he explained to me, the purpose of the foundation is to create a living Islam, especially for younger American Muslims. That is Dr. Abdallah. Sitting next to him is Bishop Robert Morlino. Bishop Robert Morlino was born December 31st, 1946, in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I have family there, by the way. An only child, his father, Charles, died while he was in high school, his mother, Albertina, in 1980. He was raised in northeastern Pennsylvania, graduating from Jesuit High School in Scranton. He entered the seminary for the Maryland Province of the Society of Jesus and was ordained to the priesthood for that Jesuit province in June of 1974. His education includes a bachelor's degree in philosophy from Fordham, a master's degree in philosophy from Notre Dame, a master of divinity from Weston School of Theology in Cambridge, and a doctorate in moral theology from the Gregorian University in Rome, specialization in moral theology and bioethics. He's taught philosophy at Loyola College in Baltimore, St. Joseph University in Philadelphia, Boston College, Notre Dame, and St. Mary's College. He served as an instructor in continuing education for priests, religious and laity, director of parish renewal programs as well. In 1981, he became a priest of the Diocese of Kalamazoo, and he served there as vicar for spiritual development, executive assistant, and theological consultant to the bishop, as moderator of the curia, and as promoter of justice in the diocesan tribunal. He served as administrator of a number of parishes and as rector of St. Augustine Cathedral in Kalamazoo. He was scheduled to begin a full-time faculty appointment as professor of theology at Sacred Heart Major Seminary in Detroit when, in July of 1999, Pope John Paul II appointed him the ninth bishop of Helena. He was appointed the fourth bishop of Madison on May 23, 2003, was installed in August of that same year. He served as chairman of two committees within the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, the Bishop Committee on the Diaconate, which deals with matters concerning the Ministry of Permanent Deacons in the Church in the United States, and the Ad Hoc Committee on Healthcare Issues and the Church, which assists the bishops in responding to moral and theological questions surrounding specific healthcare situations in their diocese. In 2005, Bishop Morlino became chairman of the board of directors of the National Catholic Bioethics Center. If you want to know about Bishop Morlino in depth, I have more information here. Finally, we have Rabbi Lori Zimmerman. Rabbi Zimmerman was educated at University of Wisconsin. She was ordained by the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College outside of Philadelphia. It's interesting that she has been involved in all kinds of volunteer work, a lot of it social justice, including the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice, Refuser Solidarity Network, Rabbis for Human Rights, and did I leave something out? Madison Jewish Community Council. And she is presently, she also has interned at a number of organizations. She was rabbinic intern for Rabbis for Human Rights and also for the Greater Philadelphia Progressive Clergy. And she is presently the rabbi at Congregation Shaarei Shamayim here in Madison. And so, Dr. Abdallah, if you will begin, please. One thing I've learned today, which is that the Muslims are far more advanced technologically. I guess we should all...
So this session is about tradition and how we relate to it and how we relate to the traditions of each other. And I'd like to begin by a phrase I heard many years ago, which is that you can kill somebody by a definition. You know, if you define blacks, Hispanics, Jews, any other people in a particular way, and that definition sticks, then they bear the burden of that. It becomes the default position. So I think what we have to be really careful about in this is not to define each other, that each person defines himself or herself and they define their own traditions. Now, the word tradition that we're talking about today is a really big word. And I think that when you talk about a Judaic tradition, a Christian tradition, an Islamic tradition, that very use of the singular throws it off, because actually there are many traditions. And all these religions are polysemic religions. Their texts are polysemic. So they have lots of interpretations. They have many different schools of thought. And so I think also that one of the things that you have to do right here is that, you know, if you're speaking about a particular tradition that you belong to, then you have to position yourself within it. Otherwise, really what you say is generalities that don't have a great deal of meaning. So I myself am a Muslim. I'm a Sunni Muslim. I am theologically an Ash'ari, a Maturidi. I won't explain what that means. By law, I'm a Maliki. By Sufism, I'm a Junaidi. So that would be the tradition in which I locate myself. And I think it's really important to do that. Then it becomes meaningful that you have a particular tradition. And I think also that a tradition that I've spent decades learning, I really don't appreciate people who tell me what it means. I really don't think also that even if people are very sincere and even if they study it, you know, in college, that they probably still don't know but very little of that tradition, which is the cumulative work of thousands of people over hundreds and hundreds of years. Speaking about the Islamic tradition, and particularly the one to which I belong, I think it's fair to say that in that tradition, one of the ways that you might be able to define it is that a man or woman of good intellect and circumstances should be able to master that tradition in a lifetime. This was something essential to the Islamic tradition, so that the bearer of the tradition is expected ultimately to be like what we might call a Renaissance man or Renaissance woman, that you ought to be able to take in the whole thing. How do you do that? Well, the reason why I mentioned it is because the secret to that was what is called rooting of knowledge. The rooting of knowledge. That's a big thing in the Islamic tradition. And at the very core of the rooting of knowledge is definition. That when we talk, we have to define. We have to set terms. That if I talk about tradition, what do I mean? If you talk about tradition, what do you mean? And can we come together? In other words, can we have a common definition about that? So in getting the definitions, in getting the terms, and also in setting the universals, then it's possible to bring it all together. Otherwise, it's just a whole lot of facts, a huge library. But if you're able to root it, and this was very important in the Islamic tradition, then given an intellect and a good life, you should be able to bring it together. You should be able to make sense of it all. Now, in this particular session, there are actually a lot of things that need to be defined. I don't see any need for me to do that. What I would like to do, though, is to look at the Islamic tradition, the one that I belong to or claim to. But I think that before we talk about that, because one of the main things we're interested here is how do traditions abide with each other? And so my point of view on that is, first of all, that traditions are huge. So the idea that I can know your tradition and you can know my tradition, I find that very difficult to accept. I mean, these are all really rich traditions. I've taught comparative religion. I've studied a lot about Judaism. I've studied Hebrew and Aramaic. I've studied a lot about the Catholic faith. But I know that what I know about that doesn't count. You know, it doesn't bear any authority before a rabbi or before a priest. So I think what's really important is that in living together, there's a culture. And I think this is what we have right here. There's a culture of respecting each other and being able to speak with each other on that basis. Imam Malik, whom I follow in law, was a great scholar of law. He used to teach his students that half of knowledge is to say, I don't know. So he used to make his students say that, I don't know. And I think that's really very important for us, because we do have to have knowledge of each other. We do have to study about Islam and about Judaism and about Christianity in a very objective and very intelligent way. But at the same time, it's very important to understand that I don't know. I don't know you, and I don't think you're going to really know me. So that's half of knowledge. In other words, I learn about you as much as I can, but at the same time, there's a certain respect that comes by acknowledging that I cannot define you, and I cannot tell you what your tradition is. And in Islam, we call that adab, which is good behavior. It's also the same word that is sometimes translated as humanism, because there's a connection, in fact, that has been studied by Western scholars between the tradition of adab, of humanism in the Muslim world, and the rise of humanism in the Western world. Scholasticism and humanism, they both have parallel traditions in the medieval world and in the medieval Islamic world. So again, it's a sort of political correctness. Again, one that doesn't mind asking questions, but still is very careful about where it positions itself. And I think that one of the most important aspects of that, the process of learning to say that I don't know, you know, and having edeb, is also renovating cognitive frames. You know, because, you know, a lot of times I've seen in interfaith that we talk about content. I believe this, you believe this, this is my tradition, you know, this is your tradition, this is our history. Content is of very little value until you have a cognitive frame that knows how to file it away. So as long as we have limited cognitive frames, then it's not possible to understand these things. And, you know, if the cognitive frame is narrow, then whatever does not fit in that frame bounces off. It doesn't change the cognitive frame. So therefore, we've got to look at cognitive frames, the way that we look at each other, the way we talk about each other, the receptivity that we have. And I would say that, again, you don't change the frame by content. The frame will reject the content, or it won't understand the content. But one of the best ways to change cognitive frames, to expand them, is personal contact. And so therefore, I would say that in coming together here, that the best thing we do is actually coming together here and getting to know each other and getting to see a human face that represents that particular tradition. There's an example of that that I learned in Chicago about a year ago of a young woman who now works in interfaith, and she was an evangelical. You know, very staunch. And a Muslim student at the university where she was working was doing a paper on exotic religions. So he came up to her and he asked her if he could get 50 questions. And she agreed. And so he went through the 50 questions, and then at the end she said, okay, you give me the questions and I'll ask you. And in the process of that, she learned who he was. And she learned that he prayed 5 times a day, that he didn't do certain things, he did other things. And she never became a Muslim. She's a wonderful person. But that changed fundamentally her attitude towards Islam. And again, it's that human contact, because that's really ultimately what we know about each other. We know our identities. And getting to know that person is absolutely fundamental to that. And of course, then, as I said before, meaningful exposure. There does have to be content, no question about that. There has to be meaningful exposure, but first cognitive frames, I'd stress that. And the Arabs say, we are the enemies of what we do not know. We are the enemies of what we do not know. So it's very important to get that basic knowledge, and again, to get it with humility. Now, getting to my tradition, and I picked the best here to sort of represent what I'd like to stand for. But a lot of the great tradition, great scholars of the Islamic tradition were polymaths. And again, this was part of that idea that you should be able to master all sorts of things, but you have to go about it correctly. You have to get in at the right point. So I just wanted to begin illustrating this tradition through Ibn al-Haytham. And Ibn al-Haytham was, we'll leave that, but Ibn al-Haytham, who's called in Latin al-Hazm, was a 11th century scholar. He is a Sunni theologian and a religious scholar. So he's not a secularist, he is a religious scholar. He mastered the scientific method. He's known to this day for his work in optics, in ophthalmology, visual perception, philosophy, mathematics, astronomy, physics, engineering, psychology, medicine, and anatomy. He was a brilliant man, no question about that. But again, he's not unique in having that kind of a CV. But the reason why I mentioned him before getting into the tradition is because of the fact that when he writes on optics, or he writes on the other sciences that he mastered, he will begin by acknowledging the ancients. And this is a fundamental part of the tradition, that you belong in a chain, and you have teachers and masters, and you acknowledge them. And I love that in the case of Ibn al-Haytham, because his masters in optics and other fields, they're not Muslims. They're Greeks, Persians, Indians, and he will mention them. He mentions them with the greatest respect, as you know, that I could not be here where I am today if it were not for them. So that's a fundamental aspect of tradition. In fact, I think in defining at least tradition from my point of view, that's an essential part of it. So I wanted to talk a little bit about tradition as a methodology. First of all, there's that master-disciple relationship. And I believe it was Rabbi Diamond that talked about that as well, or one of the other people here, that you know, you have this relationship between, it was Rabbi Diamond who said that, you have this relationship between the master and the disciple. And in fact, the disciple serves the master. So therefore, it also means that the tradition is authoritative by nature. You know, authority is there in its very essence. And that has to be taken into account because, in fact, the tradition cannot be religious tradition if it doesn't have that underlying base of intrinsic authority. It is an authoritative interpretation of the faith. Also, it is imitative learning. So you imitate, you follow. Again, that has that aspect of authority. There is conscious borrowing, that I take from you and I acknowledge the fact that I do that. And, of course, part of that is what we talked about with Ibn al-Haytham, that you recognize your teachers, even if they're among the ancients. You know, whoever they're among, you have to recognize them. In other words, I'm not original. You know, that however capable I may be in interpreting the tradition, that I'm still standing on the shoulders of people who are much greater than I. And I would never be able to do what I do if it were not for them. And then, of course, there's the process of internalizing that. So imitative learning is one thing, but taking that in, and that's what takes years and years to do. You can memorize, you can learn, but then it becomes you. It becomes internalized. And to master is to internalize. That's when you go from the level of being the disciple, you know, to that of being a master. I don't know how you say a woman master, but I can think of one word that would be appropriate. But and in Islam, you have lots of women masters of the law and the tradition, by the way. I have a CD set of 14 CDs on famous women in Islam. There's a big legacy of that, and a lot of them were great scholars. And continuity. That the basic idea of the tradition is that continuity, that link with the past. And I think this is really important because, you know, Toynbee used to say that religion requires community and continuity. Those are two really essential things. And tradition provides both. It provides community, but also continuity. And of course, with modernity, that's a really important issue because how do we have continuity into the future? How do we take it forward? But that's another matter. So you have continuity, and of course that continuity in our tradition, and this is going to be in the Catholic tradition with the masters, the magister, and so forth, rabbinical tradition, you have to receive permission. That you can't just go and study, you know, with the scholar and then teach. You have to have permission to do that. So the bearers of the tradition, they are the ones who verify you, and they're the ones who put you in this chain. They give you, you make you part of the legacy. Now, another thing about that, again, what I've stressed to this point is basically the authoritative nature of tradition. And, you know, I do that because of the fact that, you know, when we come to talk about traditions, we have to bear that in mind, that the ability to critique tradition is very important. I myself have, there are a lot of things that are very important to me about my own tradition, such as the way that it's affected by political developments in the classical period and things like that. But still, the very nature of tradition is that it's acceptance. And so when we want to talk about it, we have to always bear that in mind. Otherwise, you won't get very far. So then, after the internalizing of the tradition, you have the adding and the perfecting. And one of my teachers used to say in Arabic, stop where they stopped. If حيث وقفوا, stop where they stopped, meaning go as far as the scholars of the past went, ثم سر, and then proceed. Then go forward, meaning that master the tradition, understand the tradition as it was understood, and then take it further. Then add to it, interpret it. So it is that they are to be interpreted. And to be a master is to be able to add and to perfect, and in that, to build on the legacy. So again, you're taking the tradition forward. Interpreting, now, particularly in the tradition that I belong to, that one of the aspects of interpretation is that it is forbidden to apply the law blindly to any situation, that you must know the situation. And that's actually consensus in the tradition to which I belong, that you cannot take the law directly out of the books. You must understand the situation, and then you apply the law to that situation. And not to do that is regarded to be essentially disbelief. It's disobedience and it's misguidance. And so with that, and often the example that is given is that of medicine, that a doctor cannot give a prescription without seeing the patient. Okay, so you have to see the patient, and then on the basis of your knowledge of medicine, you give the proper interpretation. And finally, the tradition, if it's a tradition, in my understanding of tradition, it has to leave you in the present. Otherwise, it's like making historical fossils. You make historical fossils. The tradition is not there to make fossils. The tradition is there to be alive and to continue the legacy. So it should leave you in the present, meaning that it needs to renew, it needs to replenish, it needs to grow. Again, I just stress in all of this that traditions are big things. Whether you're talking about the Protestant tradition, the Roman Catholic tradition, the Orthodox tradition, the Judaic traditions, whatever you talk, they're huge. And they take lifetimes to master. And they do have this ability to renew and to replenish. Finally, in ending, I just want to stress that very important, in my opinion, to see tradition as a solution and not as a problem. And I think that especially in the Muslim context, it's imperative to speak within the tradition, and that's what we attempt to do. And that's because it gives you authenticity, that's what I believe, it gives you authority. And just to use one example, many of you know about Ibn Arabi. I believe Ibn Arabi is one of the greatest human beings who ever lived, certainly one of the most brilliant, a great metaphysical Sufi. And if I were to read Ibn Arabi on my own, I can never understand him. I can never understand him correctly. But if I take Ibn Arabi through the tradition of Ibn Arabi, then the whole world makes sense. So again, that's the authenticity. That's the authority that comes with tradition. Ibn Arabi had students, and his students had students. So if you take from them, then you, in my belief, really know what he was saying. Of course, a lot of people don't believe that. A lot of our universities don't teach Ibn Arabi that way. They will just take the book and start reading, and you're free to do whatever you want. But I think if you really want to understand what is there, you need to come through the tradition. That's not just for him, but for others. So the tradition gives you authenticity. It gives you authority. And when you don't speak authoritatively within the tradition, or one of the legitimate traditions, then you can always be overruled. Because the tradition wields this tremendous authority. So, you know, if you just talk on your own, that's fine, but you will be trumped. And you may be trumped by people that you don't want to be trumped by, you know, that don't have that understanding of the tradition that you yourself may represent. And then another thing, too, is that I think in all faiths, perhaps, I know among Christians, and I'm sure among Jews as well, certainly among Muslims, you have people that don't really have a tradition. They just belong to, you know, the faith in their own way. And, of course, we have that a lot as well, and that's all right. You don't have to belong to a particular tradition. But many of the more reprehensible interpretations of Islam today, like those of Bin Laden, the Wahidi, and other groups, they're not in the tradition. They don't belong to the tradition. So this is where tradition is also very important, because it can wield its authority against them. They try to look like they're in the tradition, that's studied the way they do that, but most of what they say is ludicrous from a traditional standpoint. So this is another reason why tradition has to be looked at as a solution, in my view. And to give you a really good example of that, I want to end with my paper, okay? If you want to see how tradition can really be used, go read my paper on our website, being really egoistic here, www.nawawi.org. And I have a paper there, this last one that we put up, called Living Islam with Purpose. And again, as Rabbi Diamond pointed out, our main concern in the foundation is creating a culture of Islam in the United States today, and especially for the young generation, like the young men that just walked through the door. Okay, so these are the people that we write for. And again, the tradition is rich. The tradition is not poor. So in that, I focus on five operative principles. And the first one is the primacy of reason, absolutely essential. Respecting dissent, absolutely essential, absolutely classical. Societal obligation, not just personal obligation. Setting priorities. And then finally, maxims, which are these aphorisms of wisdom that are essential to the Islamic tradition. So having said that, thank you for listening. And I'm finished.
Thank you, Dr. Abdallah. And taking to heart your caution, nonetheless, it's interesting to me how much of what you said resonates with me in terms of rabbinic tradition. Also, Dr. Abdallah very sensitively corrected an error of omission on my part. I didn't say what the section is actually about, and it is about looking critically at one's own tradition and also at other traditions. So I'm now going to ask Bishop Morlino to make his presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank Dr. Abdallah very much. This was excellent. And I am a bearer of tradition in my own context. But sometimes I'm so busy bearing the tradition that I don't think about the various layers that the word tradition implies. And I want to thank Dr. Abdallah very much. I'm happy that I chose not to focus on the word tradition in our topic, because you would have outdone me. And probably still could anyway. But what I am really focusing on is speaking critically about and among Abrahamic traditions. I'm focused more in this on the speaking about than I am the word tradition, and I think maybe this will work out just fine. It is a great honor and pleasure for me to have been invited to be with you as the Bishop of Madison, and therefore as a bearer of tradition, a leader in the Catholic Church. And I'm deeply grateful to Professor Cohen for the invitation, for our personal friendship and continued communication. the theme of how to speak critically about and among Abrahamic traditions could not be more timely from a Catholic point of view. If you haven't noticed, I yield to the point that our Islamic brothers are much more capable of technology. I'm not comfortable with that at all. So please forgive this approach. Since the convening of the Second Vatican Council in the early 1960s, the Catholic Church has been extremely active in the area of critical dialogue about and among the Abrahamic traditions. This dialogue has continued to our day, and some could argue has taken an even more productive turn as of late. I would propose three events which point to this continued interest in critical discussion, all three of which garnered no small amount of attention in the global media. In his not too far distant address at the University of Regensburg in Germany, Pope Benedict XVI quoted an opinion of the Byzantine Emperor Manuel II Palaeologus with regard to a seeming propensity of Islam toward violence. While many in the media and many who consider themselves experts in matters of religion painted the Pope's speech as inflammatory and divisive, it became clear from the Vatican response that the Holy Father did not mean, nor does he mean, to take that opinion as his own in any way, but that he simply used it as a means to undertake in an academic context, and as is evident from a complete and attentive reading of his text, certain reflections on the theme of the relationship between religion and violence in general, and to conclude with a clear and radical rejection of the religious motivation for violence from whatever side it may come. In an event which drew similar attention from many at the recent Easter Vigil Mass in St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican, Pope Benedict baptized Maghdi Alam, one of Italy's most prominent Muslims, who upon his conversion took the name Cristiano, which of course means Christian. Alam, the deputy director of one of Italy's largest newspapers, wrote of his baptism the following day, saying, "Yesterday evening, I converted to the Catholic Christian religion, renouncing my previous Islamic faith. For me, it is the most beautiful day of my life." In recent days, there has also been a call for a change in the intercession prayer of our Catholic Church's Good Friday liturgy, as celebrated in the rite of the traditional Latin Mass, in terms of praying for the Jewish people. The 1962 version of that intercession contained references to the blindness of the Jewish people and prayed that that blindness might be lifted. The newly formulated intercession in Latin prays simply for the conversion of the Jewish people to see the light of Christ. However, from various Jewish circles, especially the Anti-Defamation League, there was strong protest of this particular formulation because it seemingly was pulling back from the strong desire expressed by the fathers of the Second Vatican Council for ongoing rapport with the Jewish people. And this formulation of the intercession was seemingly promotive of an approach of proselytism. insofar as proselytism involves the connotation of pressure tactics or coercion. Certainly this was not the point of the new formulation. The Vatican recently issued a statement saying that all of the progress that has been made in terms of a more comfortable rapport and relationship with our Jewish brothers and sisters is to be affirmed, and that this reformulated intercession in Latin was in no sense to be taken as a retrenchment from the direction given by the Second Vatican Council. Indeed, nothing could be further from the truth, as was evidenced by the recent visit of Pope Benedict to a New York synagogue. These three examples provide a contemporary background against which we can consider speaking critically about and among the Abrahamic traditions. And perhaps these three instances will provide a starting point for whatever discussion might be addressed to me as a result of what I propose in this context. My reflections basically take the form of four points. As a Jesuit, I was trained to always have 3 points, and so this is difficult for me. In his encyclical Solicitudo Rei Socialis, regarding social concern, Pope John Paul the Great proposed tolerance as a virtue. This is the first point. The definition of tolerance which he proposed referred to that respect due to every human person simply because he or she is human. Even if a person were knowingly in error, each would deserve absolute respect simply because of his or her humanity. If someone were unknowingly in error, they would clearly be accorded the same respect. The Catholic Church has a tradition of believing that error has no rights, and this has not changed. But the Catholic Church never means to say that the human being, who might be in error, has no rights. In fact, each human being, simply because of his or her humanity, is worthy of love and care and respect. This is the first point that needs to be addressed as I think about speaking critically about and among Abrahamic traditions. The virtue of tolerance, as formally taught by the Catholic Church, is certainly basic to the exercise of speaking critically. Secondly, in terms of our differences, we must distinguish whether we are dealing with claimed objective truths or with a latent religious indifferentism or relativism. Certainly in the Catholic Church in our day and age, there are pockets of indifferentism and relativism which we sometimes call cafeteria Catholicism, where individual Catholics take it upon themselves to exercise a line item veto over the doctrine and discipline of the church, over the tradition. Differences between claimed objective truths are another story. Going back to the current situations which we discussed at the beginning, it is a basic conviction of Islam that they should Islamify, as best as I can understand it. And analogously, it is an equally basic conviction of us Catholics that we should invite everyone every day to meet Jesus Christ, risen from the dead, and to be converted to our Catholic faith. Conversion is basic to Islam, it's basic to us. In placing a pause on recent Jewish-Catholic dialogue, the rabbi of the synagogue of Rome, indicated in the context of our new Good Friday petition that essential to being Jewish is not being converted to Jesus as the Messiah, whereas essential to being Catholic is this very conversion. It is most useful, I myself believe, for interreligious dialogue to put the issues on the line, as it were, rather than to soften or water them down so as to build intentionally or unintentionally false hopes or expectations. If it is essential to being Jewish not to accept Jesus as the Messiah, then talk about our prayer for the conversion of the Jewish people is virtually impossible, as the rabbi of Rome points out. But for a Catholic Christian, it is impossible not to invite all to be converted to Jesus, because we believe that he is the only one who's risen from the dead. He is the unique Savior of the world, and there is no other name given to people by which they are to be saved, whether anybody believes that or not. So if we are to speak critically about and among the Abrahamic religions, we must identify and accept the reality of non-negotiables, which will present their own challenges. But we would do far better to accept these challenges than to try to soften the significance of the non-negotiables. Insofar as this has been the case for the most part in discussing the three situations with which I began, I consider us to be on a very good path indeed. The question then arises, and this is my third point, what might be the common ground for us to speak critically about or among the Abrahamic traditions, granting that there are some non-negotiables which have to be taken seriously and which can and will at times derail the dialogue in which we want to engage? The Abrahamic religions all have common philosophic roots in Aristotle. The great Islamic philosopher Avicenna proposed an argument for the existence of God based on necessity and possibility. The great Jewish philosopher Moses Maimonides similarly indicated his dependence on Aristotle and adopted Avicenna's proof as his own. And in effect, the greatest doctor in the history of the Catholic Church relied heavily on Aristotle and on Avicenna and on Maimonides for the tradition of Aristotelianism, especially with regard to the rapport between faith and reason. Aristotle, Avicenna, Maimonides, and Thomas Aquinas all believed that the existence of God could be known by reason alone, and that there were arguments which would precisely lead to that knowledge. That kind of knowledge, which is based on reason, can be called the natural law. Based upon the acceptance of this natural law, human reason alone can lead to certain conclusions about what it means to be human, on which Jewish people, Muslims, and Christians all can agree. This is why it is so important to avoid, wherever possible, religious indifferentism or relativism, because when reason loses its force to lead us to the truth, then clearly the fruitful dialogue, which we all desire, becomes absolutely impossible. Aristotle, Avicenna, Maimonides, and Aquinas, though clearly all differing in their religious convictions, all believed in the collaboration of reason with faith and in reason as leading to faith. To the best of my understanding, and I'd welcome Dr. Abdullah to correct me, it was Al-Ghazali who reflected upon that rapport between faith and reason and later rejected the approaches of Avicenna in favor of arguments based solely on the omnipotence of God. Writing in an era of philosophical skepticism among Islamic religious leaders, Al-Ghazali argued that because God was omnipotent, God must have the power and authority to be irrational if he so chose. It is precisely against that background that Pope Benedict spoke in Regensburg, affirming that God is indeed omnipotent, but consummately rational. Therefore, the Pope argued, violence, which is irrational, can never be justified in the name of God. That was the whole point of Regensburg. There is no question that certain strands of Islam have followed the path of Al-Ghazali rather than that of Avicenna. But given the Aristotelian roots of Avicenna, of Moses Maimonides, and of Thomas Aquinas, I find it hard to believe that since we do need common ground for speaking critically to and about one another, we might not return to these medieval roots based as they are in Aristotle, all of them. Otherwise, as Pope Benedict recently observed in addressing the United Nations General Assembly, our common ground might then turn out to be minimal in its content and weak in its effect. We cannot be content with common ground, which turns out to be simply a least common denominator. The natural law approach of Aristotle found a home in the Islamic tradition, and perhaps the natural law approach would be the best basis for us to speak critically to and about one another. If we can never agree upon a common starting point, then we really can never go forward. We certainly cannot, nor do we want to, force our specific revelation upon each other. We must call others to conversion, but we never want to proselytize with coercion or pressure tactics. If it is essential to Judaism to reject Jesus as the Messiah, if it is in the nature of Islam to convert others to Islam, and if it is in the nature of Christianity to convert others to Christianity, well then we cannot reasonably ask one another to move away from that which is essential. But if there were clearly articulated starting points for dialogue, then there might be some hope for that dialogue's becoming ever more fruitful. And historically, in fact, the common ground would seem to be found in the natural law considerations of Aristotle. Besides the existence of God, certainly the unique dignity of the human person and the irrationality of violence should be agreed upon starting points for our speaking critically about and among Abrahamic traditions. During his recent pastoral journey to the United States, Pope Benedict summed up these starting points of reason in terms of the golden rule, do not do to others what you would not want them to do to you. He pointed out insightfully, I believe, that from reason's viewpoint, the credibility of any religion rests with its degree of affirmation of basic human rights. Most basic of all is the right to religious liberty. If one believes in an eternal destiny, the most important human right is his or her right to pursue that destiny. Thus, reason would lead us to conclude that essential to any religion is the protection of the right of all to accept or reject that religion as a whole. The same reason would teach us again that violence, including violence in the name of God, is irrational. Such are the demands of the transcendent nature of the human person, which can serve as the indispensable starting point for all our dialogues, and which also, by reason alone, leads us to the indivisibility of all authentic human rights with religious liberty, both as source and pinnacle. Lastly, in order for us to speak critically about and among our traditions, those who are authorized to speak for the tradition, those sources of authority must be clear. I deeply regret that I was not present for the discussion of authority at the beginning of the day today in the different religions, because I need to be much better informed about that, and I admit it. While not a few Catholics are comfortable expressing their disagreement with or dissent from the teachings of the Pope, it is a fact essential to authentic Catholic faith that the Holy Father is the final authority in the Catholic Church. And if someone claims to speak in the name of the Church, the measure of the truth of that claim is the measure in which he or she is in union with the message of the successor of the Apostle Peter, the Bishop of Rome, the Pope. Insofar as there seem to be different sources of authority in Judaism or Islam, the matter becomes more difficult. As we engage in this dialogue, I would welcome some reflection. And actually, you had it this morning, and I could not be here, from my Jewish and Islamic brothers and sisters, as to how to consider the sources of authoritative teaching, both in Judaism and in Islam. I think most Catholics are in need of clarification about this matter, especially since not a few of these Catholics themselves have fallen into religious indifferentism and relativism. I know that the dignity of every human person is founded upon freedom of conscience, that is, religious liberty. And it is in that spirit of respect and tolerance, which I mentioned in the beginning, that I find myself humbled to be part of this dialogue in my own capacity as a Catholic leader. As I close, I prepared these comments before this particular event took place, but there was a communique passed out by the Council for Interreligious Dialogue at the Vatican, a communique of the dialogue with the Islamic culture, dialogue of the Islamic Culture and Relations Organization, Tehran, Iran, April the 30th, 2008. And in the communique, there were certain agreed upon final statements. And maybe, could we pass those around quickly?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And the agreed upon statements are around the back. You can look at the front. You can look at the front for background data, but it's the conclusions of this Islamic Christian dialogue, which are very fresh, that strike me as very interesting in the present context. And you will get them, but I'm just going to read them. And I'm happy to see that I seem to be on the same track. And these are agreed upon in the communique. Faith and reason are both gifts of God to mankind. Faith and reason do not contradict each other, but faith might in some cases be above reason, but never against it. Faith and reason are intrinsically nonviolent. Neither reason nor faith should be used for violence. Unfortunately, both of them have sometimes been misused to perpetrate violence. In any case, these events cannot question either reason or faith. Both sides agreed to further cooperate in order to promote genuine religiosity, in particular spirituality, to encourage respect for symbols considered to be sacred and to promote moral values. Christians and Muslims should go beyond tolerance, accepting differences while remaining aware of commonalities and thanking God for them. They are called to mutual respect, thereby condemning derision of religious beliefs. Generalization should be avoided when speaking of religions. Differences of confessions within Christianity and Islam, diversity of historical contexts are important factors to be considered. Religious traditions cannot be judged on the basis of a single verse or passage present in their respective holy books. A holistic vision, as well as an adequate hermeneutical method, is necessary for a fair understanding of them. The participants expressed their satisfaction with the level of the presentations and the debates, as well as the open and friendly atmosphere during the colloquium. The next colloquium will be held in Tehran within 2 years, preceded by a preparatory meeting. So the concerns of this dialogue, unbeknownst to me at the time that I prepared my reflections, seem to dovetail very well with the reflections, and I'm just grateful for that, because I want to be, for you, not a bearer of any personal opinion of my own, but an authentic bearer of the Catholic tradition in very humble respect toward all of us as we continue to move into the future. So thank you again for this welcome, for your welcome, and for this opportunity, which I find to be a great honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bishop Morlino, for your refreshing candor and forthrightness. And I do want to make an offer. We Jews have celebrated Passover not that long ago, and at the Seder we ask 4 questions. We have 4 cups of wine. We have 4 languages of redemption. So if you still have an issue with 4, we could be helpful.
4 is okay. Great.